I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. You may hope it will go away, but the economic crisis is worsening. The government announced today that AIG, the struggling insurance giant, will get another $40 billion in financial aid from the Treasury Department on top of the $123 billion AIG received last September. Automakers are also begging Washington for help, and China has announced an FDR-style plan to rebuild its economy. So where are we in the global financial crisis? Well, John Cassidy is contributing editor at Portfolio and staff writer for The New Yorker. John, first of all, why is the Treasury Department bailing out AIG, which used so many of those financial instruments called derivatives, sort of like unregulated bets, and not bailing out the auto industry?
Well, that's a very good political question. I mean, the financial answer is that AIG got there first in the middle of the financial blow-up we had a month ago. And the government at that stage, Lehman had just gone bankrupt. AIG was threatening to go bankrupt. They thought, because of all the derivatives, which you mentioned, that it has outstanding, if AIG went under, it might bring a lot of other financial firms down with it. The government is basically running this company through a new set of managers. It's just in dire shape. And the government is just desperately trying to get hold of the situation by pumping more and more money in.
Well, and that's AIG. And as to the auto industry, former Dow Jones executive, Wall Street Journal Detroit bureau chief Paul Ingrassia says today that if the car industry gets any help, the management there should be fired as well. And shareholders should lose their equity.
Yeah, I mean, the car industry is going to be a real political hot potato because in some sense, there's more jobs at stake here than there were on Wall Street. Up to 2.5 million jobs, apparently, are linked in some way or another to the auto industry. I'm sure if the government took them over completely, they would replace the management. At the moment, we haven't got that far. It looks like the automakers are looking for a similar type of bailout that Chrysler got in the 1980s, which would involve the government guaranteeing their debts. Yeah. But again, it's very unclear, and things are worsening by the day in the car industry.
Well, and just take a look at banking, because there are reports that Barack Obama might require banks that get any of the bailout money to make loans. Now, right now, we're hearing banks are hoarding the money. So what is the status of the bailout when it comes to banks?
Right. Well, the American government took a different tack to the British government. In the U.S., partly because of ideology, I think, and partly because they were trying to attract private capital at the same time, the Treasury Department just gave this money to the banks with very few strings attached, which obviously is very, very unpopular politically. And it looks like Barack, responding to the popular outrage, is going to demand some strings to be attached to the preferred shares that they've invested.
Let's look at China announcing its own $586 billion stimulus plan today, which includes new railway, subway, airport projects,
right,
to employ people losing factory jobs. I mean, is there some sense in the U.S., hey, wait a second, that was a U.S.-born plan under FDR. Why aren't we doing that?
Yes, this is China, the Chinese government adopting the policies of FDR, old-fashioned Keynesianism, using public money to build public works. China can afford it a lot more than we can, of course. They're running a big budget surplus. We're running a big budget deficit. Looks like the Barack Obama administration are going to try to get more public investments, but there's a big internal debate about how much they should do it, how rapidly they should do it. The deficit is going to be the big constraint in the U.S. There are already some estimates that the budget deficit might be as high as $1 trillion next year, which is, it's never been anything like that.
Well, you write about traveling to Japan in 1998 during the Asian financial crisis with then Clinton Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, who's now on Obama's short list. And he was essentially telling the Japanese to overhaul their financial system, make it more American. Now, back then, Summers backed open markets and deregulation, something that was called the Washington Consensus.
Yes, to be fair to Larry, since then he has rethought some of this and is now a lot more critical of financial deregulation in particular. He's still a big supporter of free trade. But I think, you know, there would be a bit of an issue if we appointed him Treasury Secretary and sent him to tell other people what to do. They would say, well, Larry, you know, if we'd have taken your advice 10 years ago, we'd be in the same state you are now. So, you know, that's an issue I think they're going to have to contend with if they appoint him Treasury Secretary.
John Cassidy, in just the few seconds we have, what do you think the number one thing is that has to happen? As you say, the situation is getting increasingly worse. What's the number one thing that needs to happen?
Well, the thing it's not really talked about enough, I don't think. The big issue that underlies almost everything is the housing market. That's what underlies the financial crisis on Wall Street, which is really the first task. And we need some way to stabilize house prices, whether it's by the government buying up troubled mortgages in a bigger way than the Treasury Department has said, whether it's forcing the banks to renegotiate with people who are getting ready to default, whether it's some sort of New Deal type new institution where the government goes in and issues new mortgages. There are all sorts of ideas. It's a very difficult issue, but that is the one thing, I think, which could put a floor on the financial crisis and allow the economy to start recovering of its own accord. As long as the housing market keeps falling, and it's falling as we're speaking, the economy, it really isn't going to turn around.
And right now, all of those things you mentioned are not yet happening.
No, I mean, they're all very difficult, and the Obama people have said that they're interested in this sort of thing, but so did the Bush administration. It's very awkward politically because you are actually going to be bailing out some people who probably don't deserve it. And, you know, people who've been paying all their mortgages and haven't walked away from their mortgages are going to be angry. But it's just going to take some, I'm afraid Barack is going to have to spend some of his political capital on introducing something which might be politically unpopular in the short term. But if it works, he'll ultimately get the benefit of it.
John Cassidy, contributing editor at Portfolio and staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, foreclosed homes have given a boost to at least one industry. Jose Reyes and his wife Mena run a company in Florida preparing foreclosed homes for resale. Doing that is called trashing out. Jose's son Paul is editor-at-large of the Oxford Magazine. He's written about working with his dad for Harper's. And Paul, these are homes in Florida from which people have been evicted, left quickly. You try to figure out what happened from what you find. Give us the list from the first home.
An x-ray of a back and a card from a daughter, you know, encouraging her mother to hang in there, etc. A letter from the sheriff, unpaid bills, notices from debt collectors, that sort of thing. This was someone who had had an accident and couldn't pay for her medical bills and lost her home.
Well, and there's hula hoops and pictures of children and mm-hmm. clothes, bags of clothing and big screen TVs. What's it like when you and your dad and his two-man crew go up to a house and know that you're going to start this process?
It's daunting. And I also should say that after a while you find yourself, because you're doing this day after day, house after house, and these houses are in such a state of squalor, you start to become numb to it because they're awful. I mean, and, you know, on the other hand, some are neatly arranged and cleaned before the homeowners left, almost as if a last dose of homeowner pride had kicked in, and they would arrange things like the Christmas ornaments in the corner and the magazines stacked up on the counter, and maybe there was a little bit of popcorn on the floor, but it had mostly been vacuumed. And there was this hollowness, and some of these houses were lost before even having been moved into. The garages weren't even finished. And so that was kind of chilling in its own way.
Well, you're right. Every house, whether it's covered with fleas and animal feces, or if it's, as you've been describing, creepily tidy with a waterfront view, they all feel lost. And you also said you'd see in some of these homes evidence of rager theory.
We've seen a couple of circumstances where it looked like there was just one last hurrah, and liquor bottles were all over the place, and they knew they were stepping out into, I guess, an uncertain future and just decided to step into it hungover. But, you know, there were also homes where the homeowner, knowing that he or she was losing it, they would leave messages for whoever was taking over the home and tear holes in the wall and all sorts of stuff.
Tell us a little bit about the process. Your father and his wife have a company. They work as intermediaries between the bank and the owner. And the bank asks them to prepare a home. They also end up trying to negotiate to get the people out. Are you expected just to go there when it's foreclosed? Do you have a sheriff come with you? How does it work?
Well, most of the time, the house has been empty for quite some time by the time we get there. Normally what happens is my father's wife will receive an email from the bank listing an address. My father goes to the address to see if the house is occupied. If it's occupied, he lets Mena take care of it, Mena, his wife. Sometimes she can negotiate what's called a cash for keys offer, whereby she gets the bank to agree to give the homeowner, let's say, anywhere between $500 and $2,000 to help them move. And it usually works.
Tell us about a house you describe in the beginning of your article. It's the home of Cindy and Robert. Your dad's Jimmy the Lock, and you're starting to go through the stuff. There's helmets and bags of toys, animals, and dolls. Why do people leave so much?
Well, I mean, you can imagine. It might be under the circumstances, people are hanging on as long as they possibly can. And when they know it's time for eviction, they try to leave as quickly as possible and sometimes just can't get it done. The logistics are just too difficult. It's funny. In that house, my father mentioned to me that toys are the most common thing that he finds, and weights, probably because the weights are too heavy to lift and get out of there at the last minute. And toys, I imagine, because they're a way of distracting the children in those last months under such duress.
And at that point, they may have no home to bring those toys to. Well, Paul, in another house, you find the belongings of a woman who seems to have spiraled out after her husband's death. She was living on Social Security. Would you read from the list of the things you found there?
Sure. This is the house of a woman named Sue, and it's one wicker throne, one walkie-talkie, the White Album, 15 pairs of women's shoes, a Mother's Day card signed Love Us, and a pair of glasses. She was an intense reader, and there are books everywhere. And what I deduced was that it had something to do with her late husband, because as we worked our way through the house and toward the back, in this shed were all the belongings and books, golf clubs, yearbooks, etc., that belonged to this late husband. It was as if they were put in there and had been sitting there for a decade, being eaten by the humidity and the millipedes and so forth.
You do the work with your dad and with, as I said, his crew, yeah. Ismael and Hector.
I mean, these guys have seen it all. They're real workhorses. I mean, it's interesting. I was talking to my dad recently about how much they haul, and one house alone ended up being 53,000 pounds of just trash from one house.
Well, and you write that all of that stuff, all the pounds, it's shocking every time. Because what does it say to you about the people?
That, to me, remains the essential mystery of this. And the best that I could deduce was that it just came at the end of someone's rope. When you see it in a house in such disarray, I suddenly could see the emotional breakdown and the kind of psychological disarray into which a homeowner had been thrown because of just how traumatic it is.
Well, and there are cases where you've been lined up by the banks to do the trash out, but the people refuse to leave the house, and you have had to go with the sheriff to make sure that they're not there. And on one occasion, someone was when your father's wife went, and this man really was at the end of a rope.
Well, they actually all went. Mena went, my father went, and the crew. You know, Mena says she had just a strange feeling about this one, and there was some hesitation at first, but the sheriff decided to go through with it. And apparently he answered the door kind of nonchalantly, wasn't surprised, and just asked everyone to wait a minute, and that he would gather some things, and went into the bedroom and shot himself.
And that explains why you and your dad get a prickly feeling when you walk up to a house. You don't know what you're going to find behind a closed door. That's Paul Reyes talking about his experience trashing out foreclosed homes with his dad. Paul is editor-at-large of the Oxford American Magazine. We're going to find out what happened when he sought out a man whose house he had trashed out. Also later today, what might President-elect Obama's first executive decisions be? We'll be back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Paul Reyes, editor-at-large of the magazine The Oxford American. He's also worked with his father cleaning out foreclosed homes, and he wrote about that in Harper's Magazine. And Paul, in addition to helping your dad, you started looking closely at the industry. You go to a RE/MAX office, you meet a real estate agent who tells you the range of people affected by foreclosure. There were speculators who were making millions flipping homes in this really hot Florida housing market, buying houses in the morning, selling in the afternoon, for a $100,000 profit. Then, of course, the market disappears and they're stuck with these homes. But then there are also the people we've heard of, you know, who, for instance, were promised that their monthly payments would be $1,200 a month. They go into the signing, it's $1,700 a month, and people just don't want to walk away. Paul, tell us what you found about how this happens, because you started doing this with your dad in 1998.
Back then, most of the circumstances involved some kind of economic trauma. You know, an accident or a divorce. This time around, it's all over the map. It's risky investment. It's carelessness. It's people being conned and suckered.
Yeah.
And because it is so widespread, we can't quite get a grip on the source of the problem. It's not one thing.
Well, in fact, you speak to a fellow named Joe Logan. You met him at a Denny's fast food restaurant, and he told you what had happened. He'd been in prison on drug charges for 18 years. According to all his neighbors, found God, got a job, got a voucher to buy a house in the mail. Said he could get one for $50,000. And the agent told him that his payment would go from $650 a month to $500 after a year, but it didn't. It shot straight up. What did he say to you about finding himself in that position of having to just... He just walked away from everything.
He did. You know, Joe is fascinating to me because he was the first vanished homeowner that I had met. I was cleaning out the house. The yard, he had a Rottweiler. And I guess the Rottweiler had a bad case of fleas. And so we couldn't even enter the house the first time because we were just getting devoured by these fleas. So as we were spraying the yard, his neighbor came out. And the neighbors themselves are fascinating because they kind of act like a Greek chorus filling in on the missing pieces of the plot of where the owner ended up. But in meeting this neighbor, I gave him my number because he said that Joe would come around just to chat because they were friends, and asked him to pass my number along. And lo and behold, Joe called. And I explained to him that I was a journalist, but I was also working with the crew, trashing out his stuff. And, you know, I was a bit nervous in meeting with him because I wasn't quite sure what I would represent to him and if he would, you know, take a swing at me or what. But it was a profound conversation. I mean, he wanted to make sure that I used his name, that I told his story. And even when I offered to see if we could recover whatever was left of his stuff, he just said, let it go. And, you know, surprisingly with Joe, I got the sense that he had not lost his faith completely in the idea of home ownership and in other things. And that was remarkable to me that, you know, he actually had plans on maybe someday owning a home again.
Yeah, but as you point out, he probably won't own a home, and it's going to be hard for him to have credit of any kind.
Yeah, and you know, I just didn't really feel like breaking that to him.
He asks you, by the way, I read somewhere that they can, if I get money in 6 months, they can come get it from me. Is that true?
Well, the thing about it is that Joe represents a lot of people, and I'm one of them, where we don't quite know the nuances of how refinancing works. And this comes back to the real estate agent's point. When you get to a signing, it's $500, $2,000 more than you thought it was going to be. But you're at a point now where there's no turning back, and so you sign. All of a sudden, your mortgage goes up, just as my mortgage has just gone up inexplicably last month. People find themselves in these situations, and they don't quite know how to navigate it because it comes at you at an overwhelming rate. And in Joe's case, and I think in a lot of other people's cases, what they don't realize is that once the home is taken away, the bank can still come after what you owe them. So that people need to watch out because the trauma can follow you.
Well, Paul, at the end of your article, you leave us at an auction for foreclosed homes where incredulous real estate brokers are watching as people again overpay for homes.
There's something about that auction that was almost, the irony of it was almost too easy. But it will be interesting to see how our attitude towards home ownership is altered by what we're going through. I suspect that there will be some kind of sea change in our philosophy about home ownership and where it fits in the American dream, so to speak.
You mean whether or not everyone should be encouraged to have a home, whether there should be more rental housing for people, or whether these people who your dad trashes out should be given more of a chance to come up with an affordable way to stay?
Well, all of it. I mean, but in particular, I think, you know, the same thing that led me to buying a home, and I think prematurely, because I am upside down in my house, meaning I owe more than the house is worth, is the same thing that led Joe Logan, you know, walking into his trap. And I'm not saying that mine was a trap. It's just it's the matter of circumstances. It's that fever for wanting to be a homeowner. And it's just not necessarily right for each and every one of us. But because we associate it with good citizenship and because we associate it with participating in American economy, the American culture, it becomes this benchmark. And I think that we may have placed a little bit too much value on that benchmark. And it has led in part to where we are today.
Meanwhile, Paul Reyes, do you find yourself thinking about these people at night? Because I've just read your article and I find myself thinking about them. You know, whose hula hoop was that? Whose old fur coat was that?
Sure. No, absolutely I do. And in fact, I owe the deacon a call.
The born-again prisoner.
Joe Logan, yeah. I'm obviously compelled to follow up with him and see how he's doing. I don't know. You can't really do an article like this without becoming attached to some degree to your subject. It's just human.
Paul Reyes, editor-at-large of the Oxford American, who also wrote an article about his experience cleaning up foreclosed homes with his dad in Harper's Magazine. And Paul, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today is the birthday of the Marine Corps. Tomorrow is Veterans Day, and we're going to hear the story of the Marine they call the greatest war hero you've never heard of. I'll see Lily Marlane, the story of the anthem of World War II that was loved by both German and Allied troops. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, are organically grown foods that much better for you than food that's conventionally grown, or is it better just to eat more fruit and veggies, regardless of how they're grown? Back after the news, here and now. One of the great rituals of American democracy is taking place in the White House today. President-elect Barack Obama and his wife Michelle welcomed by President and Laura Bush. Because of the global financial crisis and two active wars, the meeting is taking place earlier than usual this year. And come January, the new president is expected to hit the ground running early as well. John Podesta heads Obama's transition team and said this weekend that Obama may act immediately once in office to reverse some controversial Bush administration decisions. Those will likely include using Obama's executive powers to stop drilling for oil and gas in Utah and to free federal funding for stem cell research. Wall Street Journal reporter Jonathan Weissman joins us. And Jonathan, you wrote recently that the new administration will take a two-step approach. What do you mean?
Well, they come in and there will be a first, an effort to really just take down some low-hanging fruit, build some momentum. That would probably mean some executive orders that would come down immediately. As John Podesta said, they would like to stop these leases that are just about to go out right now in sensitive land in Utah around the Arches National Park and the Canyonlands National Park for oil exploration. And then there's probably a few other ones. Remember, there's stem cell research that can be done by executive order to allow for expanded use of federal funds for embryonic stem cell research. And then there's the back and forth over what's known as the Mexico City language, which basically says no international family planning organization can get any federal money, even if an outside peace wing of that organization is offering abortion counseling.
This is the so-called gag rule, which is a ban on federal aid to family planning organizations that counsel women on the availability of abortion. And it was first put in place by the Reagan administration, reversed by the Clinton administration, reinstated by the current Bush administration. And so you're saying the thinking is it will be taken away again by an Obama administration?
Yes. I mean, the Clinton administration basically showed that it can be done without too much political upheaval. Then they will move legislatively very quickly on three things. They will do a big economic stimulus package. The Congress will probably pass a stem cell research bill, too, this one with money attached. You can use an executive order to expand stem cell research, but it's up to Congress to actually fund it. And then third, they will almost certainly quickly pass the bill that President Bush vetoed twice to expand the children's health insurance program funded through an increase in the tobacco tax. That was vetoed twice, but it showed that it had very broad bipartisan support.
There are also reports that there's a group within the transition team already working on plans to close the Guantanamo Bay facility. Tell us more about that.
Yes. I mean, this is a promise that President-elect Obama made constantly on the campaign trail, that he was going to send a signal to the world by closing Guantanamo. And there's really no reason not to do this now, because the Supreme Court has said that these prisoners have habeas corpus rights and are entitled to some federal recourse in federal courts. So he's going to go ahead and do that, bring the what remains of the prisoners in Guantanamo to federal court here and close down that prison.
Well, you write that after these initial proposals, the new administration plans to regroup and build support for four reforms. Now, what are those?
this is something that Rahm Emanuel, the new chief of staff, has been talking about even before the elections. He likes to talk about reform in energy, in taxes, in financial services, and in education. By putting it under the rubric of reform, instead of saying we've got this legislation ready to go, what he's saying is we'd like to hold hearings, we'd like to build support. Remember, Rahm was part of the Clinton White House in 1993-94. They know that there is real peril in moving too quickly without knowing that you have the political support behind what you're doing. So, you know, they might move sooner rather than later, but they still want to know that Congress is with them and that the American people are with them when they move on the big items like raising taxes on the rich and like huge infusions of money for energy spending, but paid for by this global warming cap and trade system in which companies would have to pay money for the right to emit greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide.
Right, and as everyone has been saying, a lot of these plans might be shelved given the current economic crisis. But I'm just wondering, we began by talking about what a President Obama might do through executive order, and President Bush's expanded use of executive orders has come under a lot of criticism. Is there any concern on the Obama team about, you know, making use of this power that many on the team feel has been abused?
Well, it is ironic that actually something that he has criticized, Senator Obama has criticized, you know, the imperial presidency, is also something that's going to give him enormous powers. I mean, he is coming in to a White House transformed by the use of executive powers by the Bush administration. And, you know, once he has those powers, he's not going to be that quick to give them up. Now, they are going slow. I mean, these things like stem cell research, like oil and gas leases, and the Mexico City language we discussed, these aren't huge things, and they are to be expected. I think that they are going to approach that cautiously. That said, once in power, you know, people are loath to give up power that the last administration might have amassed.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jonathan Weissman on what the future agenda of Barack Obama may be. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Barack Obama hasn't even taken office yet, but there is spirited talk about the potential Republican presidential field in 2012. Politico.com reports that two potential future GOP candidates, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, will be in Iowa this month. Huckabee's already a familiar face there. He won the 2008 caucuses there, you'll remember. He's also scheduled five stops in South Carolina, which holds the first Republican primary in the South in 2012. John McCain won there this year, pretty much ending Huckabee's campaign. As for Jindal, his trip to Iowa will be his first. The anti-tax crusader Grover Norquist tells Politico that the 37-year-old Jindal will be president one day, just doesn't know when. Politico asked Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour about his interest in a presidential bid, and Barbour said, "One of the worst things that can happen to the Republican Party in our effort to rebuild is for a bunch of people to start running for president. Anyone harboring that ambition should wait until after 2010. As for former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, Politico says he's very much uncertain about another run, that he's watching the direction the party takes, particularly with regard to Sarah Palin, who will make a high-profile appearance at the Republican Governors Association meeting this week and is also due to appear on the Today Show tomorrow. Of course, right now, no one is saying they plan to run in 4 years, but with this, we launch our coverage of elections 2012. Oh, joy. And just a reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, where you can also download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And before we go today, inside the minds of children whose parents are away at war, you're listening to Here and Now. Question: are organically grown foods safer and more nutritious than conventionally grown foods? It's an important question since organic foods usually cost more and people have become so cost conscious. Judy Foreman writes the syndicated column Health Sense for the Boston Globe. And Judy, with this question, you've waded into a loaded one.
I certainly have.
As you well know. Let's start with pesticides. We know organic food is almost pesticide free. And we know in large doses, pesticides are dangerous. In somewhat lower doses are still dangerous for children. But what about the doses the government allows in the food supply? What did the study say?
Well, it's really mixed. It's kind of the nutritionists against the environmentalists in a way. But Dr. George Blackburn, a nutritionist, and you know whom I really trust at Beth Israel Deaconess, says that there's no good proof that there's any harm in food grown with pesticides. I mean, the bigger harm is that we're not eating enough fruits and veggies, not that we have stuff with pesticides on them.
But I know that you've also talked to people and seen other studies that, you know, say, well, wait a second, we're not quite sure.
Yeah, it really is a murky area because the sort of the level of science that it takes for something to be published in a medical journal may not be the same as stuff that's published in some of the environmental journals. The environmental journals say there is harm to children, to the so-called architecture of their growing brains, their intellectual development, possible ADHD, attention deficit disorder. But again, you know, the real medical people really question this.
And we should just say that it's Charles Bentbrook, who's chief scientist at the nonprofit Organic Center, who claims that these low-dose pesticides that are allowed into food may impair brain development in children.
Yes, and he cites a number of studies in environmental journals.
So while there are parents who are going to make up their own minds and may not be willing to wait for the definitive study, they're going to err on the side of caution and maybe go organic. But what about the nutritional value?
Well, that's interesting. As a separate issue from the safety value, you know, it's actually hard to test organic foods because you have to really have the exact same soil conditions right next to the conventional conditions. And it seems as though there's more vitamin C and some other important antioxidants in some strains of organically grown food, but then there seems to be more protein in some of the conventionally grown food. So it depends on what you're looking for.
Well, there are other questions as well. There are debates about whether it's better to buy local conventionally grown food than organic food that's flown around the country. But putting all those aside, we see by recent sales figures that people are buying less organic food. It appears more and more turning to conventional foods, and maybe it's the economy. So if you're health conscious and you're finding yourself buying more conventional foods, what then do you do to, you know, make even the conventional healthier?
Well, obviously you can wash stuff, but a lot of the tests they did on the for the environmental side of things, there was still some residue of pesticides even on foods that were washed. So you probably can't get rid of pesticides entirely, but you can buy conventional food like bananas, where you can really peel that big huge skin off, and then use the organic stuff for grapes and things that are harder to peel and maybe harder to wash.
Well, and I want to go back to something you said at the beginning. The point seems to be that the bigger health problem is people not eating enough, whether
that's
conventional
right.
or organic.
That's right. Not enough fruits and veggies. And that really is the bigger concern overall in terms of kids' diets and adults' diets, too.
Well, so parents are going to have to decide for themselves. And as you said, the bigger problem may be not whether something's organic or conventional, but getting your kids just to eat more fruits and vegetables. But what about, you know, putting aside human health, what about the health of the planet? I mean, how do the environmental footprints compare, conventional versus organic?
There's less question about the health of the environment and how much better that is when you do organic farming. It reduces greenhouse gases. It reduces pollution. It really does preserve the soil much better.
No pesticides in the soil. Rotating crops.
Rotating crops. No pesticides. Exactly. But it is more expensive. It's more labor intensive to do it that way.
Which brings us back to why we've looked into this. Organic food costs more.
Yes, it costs about a third more. And in these tough economic times, that's a lot.
Judy Foreman, she writes the syndicated column Health Sense for the Boston Globe, is a regular contributor to Here and Now, and we'll post her column at our website, here-now.org, so you can see what the experts have to say for yourself. Judy, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, the song both the German and Allied soldiers fell in love with during World War II. Who was Lily Marlene? Who wrote the song of the same name? And whatever happened to them, we'll find out tomorrow.
Outside the barracks, by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night.
Back in a minute, here and now.
We will create a world for two.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. More than a million American military personnel have served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nearly 13,000 Canadian soldiers have as well. And each troop has an extended network of friends and family and children. According to the Boys and Girls Clubs of America, more than a million young people in the U.S. have at least one parent in the armed forces, and they have to make their own sacrifices, taking on extra chores, like Allison, who does the dishes while her brother Matt does the laundry. Deborah Ellis is author of Off to War, Voices of Soldiers' Children. And Deborah, you spoke with military children in the U.S. and Canada. What was the one thing that you came away with about how they felt having parents serving in wars?
The overall thing I got from these kids was a strong sense of loneliness, that a lot of them had really missed their parent when the parent was away. And then when the parent came back again, the parent was often altered. So they were lonely while the parent was gone, and they were lonely when the parent came home.
Yeah, and the things they say, I mean, just in their simplicity, are really quite profound. I think it was Tara who said, "I have no clue why the U.S. is in Iraq. I really don't." One child relates that her father told her that he saw Iraqi children playing on a dead horse, like it was a playground. And they seem to relay these things to you, these stunning statements, mm-hmm. you know, as if they were talking about the weather in some cases.
In some cases, that's true. In a lot of cases, the parents didn't want to share anything that had happened to them in the war zone because they wanted to protect the children from having to live through those experiences. But when you come back from that kind of environment, you're often going to be altered in some way. And it didn't do the children any favors when the parents didn't talk to them about what was going on, because the children would then think that the parent was angry with them, when in fact they were just dealing with these terrible things that they had seen and done.
Yeah. There are some services for these kids. There are mm-hmm. family readiness groups. Some of their parents serve in these groups that help families communicate with the military. One girl, I loved this story. I think this was Tara, who goes to a deployment group at school every second Wednesday and makes a pillow with a drawing of her dad on it and puts his aftershave on it so she can sleep with it.
Oh, that she's a wonderful child. Yeah, that was up at CFB Petawawa up in Canada.
You know, where else do the kids find solace?
Sometimes with their friends, sometimes with their church and faith communities. The ones that had the harder time, I think, were the children of the National Guard, who had very little expectation that their parent was going to be away for 16, 18 months in a foreign country, you know, possibly going to be killed. And often they were the only child in their school or even in their whole town that was involved with the military. Teachers didn't know how to deal with them, and a lot of them felt very isolated and alone.
You talked about how the parents came home altered. As one of the teenagers says, I think it's Cash, he's 17. He says his dad was in Rwanda right after the genocide. I wish I knew mm-hmm. what happened to him in Kandahar. He was also in Kandahar. I do know an American civilian was killed by a suicide bomber just a few yards from my dad. That would change anybody. You hear them try to sort of, you know, rationalize their parents' behavior.
And sometimes the parents' behavior changed for the better. Children would talk about how before they went off to war, their parent would be, you know, always at them about little things. And when their parent came back from war, the little things didn't matter anymore, that they were so grateful to be home and safe that they just kind of felt more relaxed.
Well, in fact, you met one girl in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, who said that her father was one of those who became more mellow, who drove mm-hmm. around potholes instead of going through them.
That's right. Parents would come back and they'd drive in the middle of the highway because they're used to driving in the middle of the road in Afghanistan to avoid, you know, bombs along the side of the road, and it would take some adjustment.
But then there were the parents who, you know, as we said, we mentioned one who came home from Kandahar, and he walked around that house with his son, who's 17. They didn't even speak to each other. And one girl, I think it was Mary, said that for a while her family couldn't have a phone in the house after her dad came back from Iraq. Why was that?
Just the ringing and the noise would set him off. And a lot of children talked about how things like the 4th of July fireworks were really, really hard on their parents. And some of them couldn't understand why, if their country is at war and all these people are coming back, why are we still using fireworks for Canada Day or the 4th of July? Let's just stop that for a while and give our parents a break.
Well, it's rare, but you also write about kids abused by parents when they come home. You spoke with an anonymous Canadian woman. She's 17. Her father became horribly cruel and then physically abusive.
Yeah, his experiences in Bosnia and then later in Afghanistan tipped him over the edge. He just had no way of dealing with what he had seen and done, and he took it out on his family in a very brutal way.
She said some interesting things. She said Children's Services did get involved. We do a big interview, but she was too scared to tell them anything. She didn't tell.
Well, that happens a lot with victims of violence in the home, that they're afraid that if they tell, the violence will get worse.
And she goes on to say, do you want to know the funny part? I'm planning to go into the military myself, just like my dad.
Mm-hmm. Kind of to prove that it can be done in a way that it would still leave her as a human being.
You also only, thankfully, meet one child whose parent has died. What did he tell you about that?
Well, it was very, very sad, because not only had he lost his parent, his father in that case, but it seemed like the military had lied to him and his family for a while about how that death happened, which just made it harder and harder for the family to deal with what had gone on.
His father was the first member of the California National Guard to be killed in battle since World War II, so people might actually know who that is. He said it was big news to other people, but not just to me.
Yeah.
And then they found out that it was the Iraqi soldiers that his father had been training who actually killed him.
Yeah, which makes it even harder for a kid and for anybody else to try to understand it.
His last words were just a kick in the gut. Because I guess you asked kids, a series of questions, and he parrots one back to you. He says, yeah. My advice for other military kids, I don't have any. I'm not a military kid anymore.
Yeah, he was a very sad little boy.
He just felt severed from, not just his father, but the military.
Yeah, felt disrespected by the military and just kind of abandoned. There are a lot of different experiences out there. Some of them felt very supported by the military communities, and others felt very disrespected and distanced from it. It depended on their situation.
But largely you speak with children who feel very positive about the military. Often they live on a base. Many see themselves as part of the community with responsibilities. But they can also still feel guilt. Erica, who's 17, tells you it's hard to have fun knowing that I could be laughing and singing, and right at that moment my dad could be getting shot or bombed, or maybe he's hurt or scared. So why should I have fun when he's not?
Yeah, just because they're children doesn't mean that they don't know what's going on in the world and that they're not impacted by the things that they hear. And they fear very much for their parents' safety. They fear also for their parents' well-being in terms of, does the parent have to kill anybody? What's that going to do to them? They worry about these things. And I think the more that parents talk with their kids about what's going on, the more involved they'll feel in terms of being able to do something about their situation.
By the way, I want to note that we have some construction going on next to our the radio station we broadcast from. So sorry about that, but we really wanted to speak with you. What did you find the kids had in common?
Well, one of the things I found that was very disturbing was that very few of them could imagine a world without war, that it was so much a part of their lives that it just seemed as natural as breathing or rocks that we would always have it. And I think one of the things that we can do is to start creating a dialogue. What would it take to have a world without war? How could we create such an environment? And once we put that out there, then people will start to feel that maybe it's possible.
Deborah Ellis, author of Off to War, Voices of Soldiers, Children. She spoke with us from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto, Canada. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you.